greatest threat to clean water. We can reduce the amount of chemicals we put on our lawns. First, if you must fertilize, use slow-release fertilizer and follow the instructions for proper application rate. More is not better. Also remember, the new Suffolk County law states there is no fertilizer use from November 1st to April 1st. Also consider mulching your grass and setting your mowing blade height to 3 inches for a healthier lawn. For more information on how you can help, please visit www.suffolkstormwater.com. This has been a Cornell Marine Moment brought to you by Suffolk County and Cornell Cooperative Extension Marine Program.
It's right in your own backyard. While it might be hard to believe, roughly 5 million Americans don't even know where their next meal will come from. In communities just like yours, there are many who need help. Join people across the country who are coming together with AARP, Create the Good, to end hunger. Start today. It can be as easy as giving food or money to your local area food bank or getting tips to start your own food drive. Whatever level of involvement is right for you, we've made it simple to find and help people in your area. So get involved. Go to www.createthegood.org/hunger.
What are you waiting for? All right, it's 1 minute after 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook. Time once again for Off the Wall. well. It's another Tuesday evening, and you're listening to, hopefully, Off the Wall here on WUSB. Emmanuel Wilstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
How you doing?
Fine.
Man, a few words tonight.
How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm doing all right. Doing all right for late August.
Yeah.
Late August is usually when I start to run out of steam.
Steam?
Yeah.
You run on steam?
That's what keeps us going, is steam.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm you know, home stretch, August 20th.
Till?
Labor Day. And I don't know what we're supposed to do on Labor Day other than shop in stores.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the finish line for the summer.
Great.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it was a good summer.
It was a good summer. You know what I did over the weekend?
No.
I went to Woodstock.
You did, didn't
I
you?
I went to Woodstock. It was the most amazing thing. There was a radio station that broadcast Woodstock Festival pretty much as it happened, starting... Well, okay, it was a little confusing because they started on Thursday and ended on Sunday so that they could keep the dates, I think August 15th through 18th. But actually, if you go back 50 years to when it happened, 1969, those dates were off by one day. So it started on a Friday and actually ended on a Monday morning. If you could put all that behind you, you could have a really good time having the radio up and saying, hey, Jimi Hendrix is about to come on, you know. But they did so much more than that. They didn't just play the music. They played everything between. Well, not everything, because it's a radio station. They had to do IDs. They had to bleep out certain things. But you got a real flavor for it.
This is the remastered set that they were airing, right? And that is all from tape. I'm not going to mention prices, but it's a really costly thing. But yeah, this radio station was bringing it to people immediately, especially for the anniversary. So it's sort of the combination of those two things really making it accessible and a really fun way to entertain yourself over the weekend.
It was cool because I actually had to recover from it the day afterwards because I'd been staying up so late listening. Because you had to wait, you know, you had to wait 2 hours sometimes between sets. And what the station did, of course, they went back to local programming when they were doing that, which, I would have kept playing whatever audio existed. There's this guy, Andy Zaks, and Brian Kehew, I think is how you pronounce it, engineers, who worked for 14 years restoring all these recordings. And when I say restore, they did it the right way. You and I, Kyle, we're archivists in a sense, because we're always saving things, rescuing things from destruction, and digitizing, preserving.
We're amateur archivists, right?
Well, we don't get paid for it, so yeah, I guess that makes us amateurs.
I think amateur archivists.
Damn well should be, but but the thing is, when we archive things, we like to save them in the condition that they originally aired in. This is how I feel about everything. I feel about movies, TV programs, books. Yeah, you might want to tweak it a bit 20 years later, but don't. Because what you released, what you gave to the public at the original time, that is what people should come back and see. Maybe you got something wrong. Okay, you know what? Release a second version. But don't, you know, the original Blade Runner, all right, nobody likes it, but you have to have it. It's got to be there. It's got to be there for people to see, to say, okay, let's not ever do that again. Learn, you know? So that's what these guys did with Woodstock. They basically preserved it in the way it happened, you know, the imperfections, the crackles and pops, the distortion sometimes when you plug the wrong device in. They kept all that because that is what the experience was. Yeah, they had the Woodstock album that came out a couple of years after Woodstock, which was all edited and perfected, and of course the film. But never anything like this. And it had been sitting in a warehouse in Los Angeles for all this time. Until these people found it and said, hey, let's make this something that is worthy of it.
Right, yeah. And, of course, the radio station then making it accessible because I don't know how many discs the set is. Is it
38 discs.
Almost 40 discs. Wow.
It's unbelievable. And, yeah, so as you mentioned, it's extremely expensive. But not only is it extremely expensive, it's also extremely hard to find because they only made, get this, 1,969 copies of it. Because 1969 is when Woodstock happened. So now, if you look for this, you'll find it on eBay for double the expensive price it was being offered for. So, yeah, that's if you want the perfect gift for somebody who went to Woodstock, I think this is it. Assuming they liked Woodstock. If there's something they're trying to get out of their minds, maybe not the best gift.
And they deserve it.
But at some point, I'm sure all of this is going to be distributed freely, and hopefully people can... can share it. But one thing I'd like to share with people is the stage announcements.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, what was the guy's name that was giving the announcements?
Name is Chip Monk.
Great.
I did not know that. I did not know about this before this started airing, and I started asking people on Twitter,
right,
who is this guy? This is amazing. Can I just play an excerpt of this so people can appreciate what I'm talking about here?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for your permission.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you please, would those of you who have taken up residence on the towers, please come down. There are people sitting behind you who have the same right as you, who unfortunately cannot see. It would be greatly appreciated if you'd please come down. On both towers, if you would, you may have a very good seat, but your body is blocking at least 10 to 15 people behind you. No, not up. Down, if you would, please. Please, all of you, come down. Can those of you in the back hear well? Those of you sitting on the top of the truck in the back, can you hear well? Raise your hand, please. It's all right? Thank you. You people that have placed tents in the viewing area, if there are people behind you, please, the same thing goes for those that are on the scaffolding. Please do take them down so that those behind can view as well. As far as the concessions go, it was announced once before. I'd just like to make it perfectly clear. The people who are working the concessions, supplying us with food and drink for this event, under request, as it were, from the producers, are not charging what they were charging before, which at second thought is slightly unfair. They're charging what it cost them to bring it in and to give it to you. So please, take a second check on the way out. We're making every effort to supply you with additional beverage, water, to make it as comfortable and as pleasing an event as possible. Those that feel that the freeness should prevail, as it were, or that all that which is in the concession areas should be for free, if those of you would just be so kind as to turn around when you hear that, perhaps you would have a reasonable explanation for them. It took the people who brought in the food and the drink a certain amount of funds to bring them in. I think at least they should be covered for that. As far as the water goes, what we're doing now is we're making an effort to bring in at least two at a time of the local fire trucks. This will be confirmed in a few moments. And if you don't mind being sprayed, that's one way you'll get it. So all of a sudden we'll have a little artificial rain. Fu of Santana, if you will, please. You have some equipment that's necessary for performance. Would you please bring it right backstage? Again, gentlemen, those of you who are on the towers, my concern is not for the structure. My concern is for the people behind you. If you can't reason that out, there's a definite lack somewhere in your reasoning ability. Please. I think that a display of perhaps understanding for those behind you is far better than showing just how selfish you can be. So if you would, it would certainly be appreciated by those behind you.
Oh, my God. I can listen to this guy
again,
all day.
Those of you who have your tents up.
Yeah.
He's amazing. It's simply incredible. He's still around, too. He's 80 now. And still, he was the lighting guy for Woodstock. They put this together in 30 days. They didn't have a space 30 days before the event. This is the lighting guy. They didn't have an MC. They just kind of threw him on stage. And wow, I can't stop listening.
Yeah, it goes a long way having all of these extra bits to like giving it greater context than just the recordings. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's, I think, why we appreciate all of that extra bit and the work that went into it. That's why we appreciate it so much, because it gives the event this context. And on an anniversary, like 50 years later, mm-hmm. we want to know more about that. You know, a lot of the people involved, you're not hearing the stories, or you're hearing the same old stories, or they don't want to talk about it anymore.
Exactly. You don't hear from the superstars. You don't hear from people like this that did all the work. And, you know, I learned something just by hearing the interactions. You know, he's talking to some guy from Santana. Hey, get your equipment off the stage or something like that. And you hear the interactions between the bands, the roadies, the lighting crew. And it's like they're all family. They all know each other, first name basis. Maybe they never met each other before, but they're interacting. And there's no, I mean, I know there are egos, but it's not like it feels today where, okay, you don't talk to the talent and you can't touch this because this person has to do that. And it's all too professional. This was a bunch of people just getting together and making the impossible happen. I've seen that happen. I've seen people do that in the hacker world all the time. But it's just really, really cool and reaffirming to hear it coming together like this.
Right. And there's a lot of I think that's a really important point. But there's a lot of differences given the lack of technology in two things sort of in that realm. The first being the importance of public address for announcements, because there's no way for individuals to communicate with one another. So you'd hear people talking about, or the announcements would discuss, you know, get someone their medications. In fact, that's a huge common announcement almost between each show. And you got to wonder, what medications are they talking about?
Well, in fact, there was some talk about that, because occasionally this guy says your insulin is ready at this particular point, and people are wondering, was that some other kind of drug? And also he's talking about, don't take the brown acid, because that was being passed around. That's a classic.
That's like specific and very famous. But there were a lot of other things that may very well have been serious incidents. Lost kids, announcements about people having fallen ill, and to have members of their party meet them at the entrance, stuff like that.
It got a little too specific sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, Jenny, please report to the info desk. Your mother is ill, or something like that.
Right.
You don't know. There was one. The worst one I heard was, come to the information desk as a family accident on the thruway. It's like, come on. Why are you so damn specific, letting half a million people know that this person's family might have gotten creamed on the thruway? And what's that person supposed to think while they're crawling over all these people to get there? But, you know, you live, you learn, and it's part of the experience.
The other really, really good point you made, observation-wise, as we were listening, I think, is the cleanliness of it and the fact that a lot of other performers today have drawn more people. It was really the sense of unpolishedness and the overwhelming popularity of the event, and that confluence of how they pulled it off or didn't, depending on your perspective. Mm-hmm. But that really speaks to how much producing shows like this has changed. You don't hear stuff in between sets in quite the same way,
because
every stage crew for a concert has their own intercom, or their their procedures and so on have been so finely tuned that it's really, you don't see it as an audience member. But this is much different, and was in and of itself an experiment. So you have those sort of rough around the edges moments,
and just the quiet confidence and competency of all these people that would be condemned by mainstream as hippies. They knew what they were doing. They put it together. They made it work. They made the people understand and work together. And they pulled it off. They don't get enough credit for that. Half a million people just descending on this place. We're coming to the end of these announcements here. I just want to play a couple seconds more.
City McGee, or C.T. McGee, rather, please come immediately to backstage right, which is over here. I understand your wife is having a baby. Congratulations. Could we continue, please? With pleasure. A very fond friend, Mr. Joe McDonald.
And of course, led into Country Joe McDonald and the Fish. Amazing. Can you imagine? That kid is around someplace. That kid is 50 years old. And the announcement of that kid's birth is forever ingrained in half a million people's minds as the person who was being born at Woodstock and the father being told over the PA system. I just wonder how that kid feels about all that, if they even knew.
Yeah, what a curious thing to have to be a part of your story. When people ask, where were you born?
Yeah, literally at Woodstock. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I heard a Stony Brook announcement, too. Somebody from Stony Brook meet someone. Because Stony Brook was big back then in the whole music scene, the whole hippie scene, anti-war, all of that. So I imagine it was quite a presence up there. And I'm sure a lot of people affiliated with Stony Brook have memories of Woodstock.
Being that it's in the same state, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, and I'll bet WUSB was doing something in some form. We were a carrier current AM station back then. But I'll bet, you know, maybe there are tapes somewhere lying around that we can uncover and reveal at some point. That would be kind of cool.
Maybe as a supplemental.
But, you know, the mainstream didn't get it. Walter Cronkite, who, you know, I have a lot of respect for, he did not appreciate Woodstock at all. In fact, according to this news article, he was seething on the night of August 18th, 1969. A vast music festival had just ended in upstate New York. He seemed to be unaware that everyone was calling it Woodstock. No matter, he just dismissively referred to it as a rock music festival in White Lake, New York, on the CBS Evening News. This White Lake festival had been attended by hundreds of thousands of young people, no doubt many of them hippies. The most trusted man in America didn't like hippies. They offended him, recalling in a 1997 CBS special, "During that period, I made the declarative statement, I don't care for their hair, I don't care for their looks, I don't care for their clothes, I don't care for their behavior, I don't care for anything about them." Wow. Walter Cronkite. Cronkite masked well his repugnance on the air, his rivals less so. The festival is over, said NBC News anchor Chet Huntley. Oh, I remember Chet Huntley, the Huntley-Brinkley report. Well before your time, Kyle. Then he added, glowering through thick-horned rim glasses, I remember those too, but the aftertaste lingers on. Over at ABC, the commentator Howard K. Smith, I remember him from V. Yeah. He arrived at one hysterical conclusion. Woodstock is a picture of all our future. This post-apocalyptic vision of an overcrowded America means then that overpopulation, so long predicted, has stolen upon us, and it gets worse week by week. Why blame Woodstock for overpopulation? I'll never know. Anyway, that article came from Vern Gray over at Newsday, and just goes to show how we remember something 50 years on, and at the time, it was perceived as something completely different. You wonder, 50 years from now, how the things that we talk about will be remembered. How the news events going on today, how the history that we're involved in. I think it'll be remembered in a very unsympathetic manner.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. It's been so all-encompassing over the last little bit of time. But yeah, as I look back at like decades and decades, and I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure about the trends I'm noticing. I know that there's a lot of tumult right now, and I think we all sort of anticipated it one way or another. But who's to say? I mean, we may look back and say this was like a great time, and we had it good.
Wow. Okay. I'd love to see that kind of science fiction of the future, where we look back on this time as our pinnacle.
Maybe it was our heyday.
Well, of course, it could get a lot worse. So I guess maybe that's how it could be the pinnacle.
That's what I was getting at.
All right. But it's still, you know, a sharp decline. I don't want to sound negative, but I don't want to blind myself to the things that are going on. Just today, I heard, and every time I turn on the news, I hear something that really upsets me. But this, you have to wonder, what kind of people are we turning into? You know, it just seems to get worse and worse by the day. But basically, today it was revealed or announced that the U.S. will not be vaccinating migrant families in holding centers ahead of this year's flu season, despite calls from doctors to boost efforts to fight the infection that's killed at least 3 children so far at detention centers. In general, due to the short-term nature of Customs and Border Patrol holding and the complexities of operating vaccination programs, neither CPB nor its medical contractors administer vaccinations to those in our custody. Please, there is absolutely no excuse not to give basic medical care to people who are in your control, and that is what you have chosen to do with all these people. And, I mean, I've been hearing comments from doctors all day long who are just, they cannot figure this out. Why would somebody intentionally withhold something that could save lives? It's punitive. It's nasty. It's horrible.
Especially given the conditions that they're subjected to, or just like the close quarters and the constant waves of new children coming in, just the opportunities for transmission of disease, and the fact that they've actually lost several of these kids, whether, you know, you dispute whether that was something that occurred while they were in transit and before they were in these holding centers. The holding centers are not necessarily the ideal way not a humane, I think, or ideal scenario once they've made that journey, because they're not really helping them all that much, like recover all that much. And meanwhile, this is sort of unrelated, but on the topic of vaccines, did you hear there's Ebola vaccines now in Africa? Meanwhile, in Africa, there are vaccines they're distributing. I think in Democratic Republic of Congo, to young people that will prevent them from contracting Ebola, because that's a very, very deadly disease out there and has had a resurgence. So why, for something really basic like influenza that is very easy to transmit, and in, of course, these kind of deplorable, awful conditions at the border, I mean, they should be on the front lines of the latest vaccine because it's such a high-risk scenario.
Imagine how the story would be reported if that Ebola vaccine in Congo was only administered to citizens of Congo. And if you're a citizen of Burundi or somewhere else, no, you're out of luck. How would we report that story here? You know, it would be something we would condemn and say, oh, those people in Africa, they don't know how to treat human beings.
No, that is such a good point, E. And in fact, they're giving it to young people and citizens who go back and forth across the borders. Those are the first people that are getting them, because they're going into other countries where they don't necessarily have the same controls, or they're not having the same concentration of world health efforts and NGOs or whatever. But if they go into these, you know, nearby countries and come back across the border, anything like that where they're interacting with outside populations and so on and so forth, they're making sure that they're the first people to trial this with. At least that's my understanding of how it's going to be distributed. So yeah, exactly. If it's, you know, one, you're treating humans in different sort of hierarchies and segregations. I mean, on just the medical front, it's sort of undeniable that there are other social factors in those determinations and how you treat people, which I think in and of itself is the problem, and what people have been pointing out at the border.
Now, it should be pointed out that the death rate for children from the flu is about 1 in 600,000, which sounds safe. It's still too many, but it sounds safe. And when you consider that 200,000 people are being held at detention facilities along the border, which is an awful lot of people when you think about that, you might be tempted to say, well, it doesn't sound like it's much of a threat at all. But things change when you confine people into relatively small spaces. When you have overcrowding, you might start out with the flu and then contract something else. Before you know it, you could have a real bad situation on your hands. And it's something that is so easy to deal with. And the fact that the people in charge now are not willing to even do that makes you wonder, what else aren't they willing to do? What else are they doing to make these people's lives a living hell, especially kids just starting out? This is their introduction to our country. This is their introduction to the rest of their lives. It's unconscionable. I don't recognize this country, the things that we're doing.
Yeah, you say may not be easy to implement. How about, or it's so, even if it's not so easy to implement, how about if it is so important to implement? And again, that 600,000 number, I mean, I don't know what they're basing that off of statistically, but let's imagine it's normal households spread apart, disparate in a given city, right? That's not at all the same thing as warehousing children in detention facilities. Right. That is completely different. And I find those two to be, there's a serious incongruence in using those statistics. What if that's 10%? Higher, or I'm sorry, I mean, what if it's the one kid per 600,000 is a tenth or something, just a fraction of what it would be in a detention facility? There's no distinction being made. If we use these regular housing situations for your average citizen for a situation that is abhorrent and really much, much different as far as risk, I mean, that one kid per 600,000, if we have 300,000, maybe that's 5, 10, 20 kids. But how many kids, you know, is it okay to have die in our custody on to just stick to our some principle or the, you know, to prove a point about the rule of law or whatever you convince yourself you're doing?
The other thing to remember, too, is how quickly these things can get out of control. You might think you have a handle on it. This particular strain of flu, 1919, there was a flu outbreak. It killed 40 million people. All right, these things happen very quickly, and they could easily get out of control, especially if you don't treat them. If you just let conditions like this grow and predominate, and that is what things are turning into. It's becoming normal to treat people this way in our own borders, and it's completely insane. These are. I have to point out repeatedly, these are not criminals. These are people that are simply in a country that some people think they might not have the right to be in. Things that were dealt with in civil courts before, but now are being dealt with in this particular brutal fashion. Lives are being destroyed, and people are dying as a result. And it's something that we really need to put front and center, I think, every single day. Today, just another example of it.
And of course, like the people that are supposed to benefit, I guess the whites or whatever, I mean, people are still looking for work. People are still, you know, hard up within our country. I mean, these policies are not necessarily, I think, having the so-called or the alleged immediate effect. I don't think it's not a one-to-one correlation. And having let this persist and just go on and on and on and on and on, yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's a hardline policy, but I think it's unjust and not having necessarily. It may have more side effects than actual benefits for the populace that's sort of entitled, literally and figuratively. I'm putting that in quotation, air quotes.
But he's air quoting, yes.
Yeah, but like it's, you know, the entitled, as I said, whites. You know, I don't think they're doing any better. They're probably still strung out on opioids, and you know, maybe they have. Less Spanish speaking around them, and that's a benefit. But I just don't see a one-to-one for like quality of life in this country all of a sudden getting better. In fact, I think is that the fact that we're allowing this, that we're you know co-signing this kind of treatment of people, it just, as we've noted many times, just makes our position as a nation, you know, condemning human rights, it makes us completely hypocritical.
Well, yeah, it's being,
it weakens our position.
Everything's being done under false pretenses, too, like saying immigrants are taking our jobs when they're working in places that citizens of this country don't want to work and have, you know, basically no intention of working. You want to call immigrants lazy? I mean, you can't have it both ways. Either they're taking your jobs or they're lazy. But okay, you want to call them lazy, and yet all these roundups are taking place at places of employment where these people are doing these horrible jobs that pay very little and are extremely stressful, and now they have to be broken up from their families at these jobs. It's terrible. But if you think it ends there, you are sorely mistaken, because Trump is continuing to go after people who already are in the country legally but just happen to come from the wrong places. That is why he is trying to block green cards for people that use public assistance, which is often vital to raise a family even if you work full time. Ask yourself why that is. And that's true of people who are born in this country, people who immigrate to this country. But to say that those people with green cards that are using public assistance are going to get their green cards blocked now, you know, you're taking a step away from quote-unquote illegal immigration, and now you're attacking legal immigration. Today, I'm proud to say, both New York State and New York City, along with Connecticut and Vermont, sued the federal government over those new rules. A lot of time being spent in court, but it's essential. It's the only way to fight these things. Well, other than shutting down the government and taking over the streets, but, you know, people here are so damn lazy. You want to talk about lazy? That's lazy when you don't go all Hong Kong on their ass, which you need to do.
Wasn't that impressive? Over the weekend, the 1.7 million, I think, was the final
total.
It's like
a quarter of their population or something, right? It's,
yeah.
A lot of people came out, and it's because it's important. We have to view these things as important. We have to see how they connect to us. I don't think we've done that yet. And that's just kind of sad. Well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say people, you know, are rightfully upset. And I think it's the type of thing that we all find our own way, I think, to communicate, you know, and find our commonalities. And maybe it's slower here. Maybe it's different. Maybe people don't want as much confrontation. But I think when things are pushed to a certain degree, you get those kinds of actions. And it really is. It's heartening. It's heartening to see people just showing up with their umbrellas. I mean, it's just this mass of people out there and being defiant. I mean, the airport that they took over, I think a couple days later or a day later, they apologized.
Okay.
They apologized to people for how they had taken over the airport. I just think that's so interesting that the quote rioters, but these are peaceful protesters, for the most part peaceful protesters, who occupied this airport, making the point, you know, that we're going to disrupt this transportation hub. And they really did. And of course, different airlines, I think Cathay Pacific was, some of their pilots were being chastised and stuff.
Did you hear about this? Cathay Pacific, the CEO was asked or commanded by the Chinese government, People's Republic of China, to turn over a list of all his employees that participated in those demonstrations. And not only did he refuse to do that, he gave them a list of one name, his own. That's the kind of courage we need to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just to stick up for your staff and understand that you are, you know, as a business leader. I mean, and then I think he was eventually forced out or stepped down. I'm not sure.
Really? I just heard about that today.
Really?
Yeah, okay. You might have information I don't have. But.
Okay, I may be confused. It may be somebody else, but I know that there was a lot of pressure being put on the airlines. But suffice to say that for the disruption and the people who were there, this was before people did the march, the millions of people marching, they were apologizing for having taken over, the way they had taken over the airport. I just think that's so polite, and it's maybe perhaps a mark of our own politeness here in dealing with, you know, bureaucracies and institutions that don't really represent us.
Right. You can be firm and polite at the same time. You can do both. But the important thing is to stand up for your rights and not let them be taken away from you. Now, here's something. I've been upset by this for a long time because it just doesn't seem fair. The way our electoral system works in this country, you know, there are so many issues with it. We've got the Electoral College. Okay, you have a situation where our current president lost the popular vote by 3 million. 3 million votes he lost by. And somehow it's okay that doesn't matter. That doesn't count for some reason because you can't have the will of the majority over the will of the – I don't know what the logic is. It might have worked in the 1700s. I don't see how it works now. It doesn't make any sense to me. We don't elect other people that way. Why do we do this? And how is the minority dictating things? How is that better? You have the situation where the minority keeps getting control even though they keep losing. And they lost the popular vote in the presidential election. All right. Now, the state legislatures, governorships, all of that, you have situations with gerrymandering where Republicans are in the minority, yet somehow they keep getting control and winning more power and clinching it for years to come. I mean, they know how to play the game, but is the game fair? Here's another thing. The Senate, the U.S. Senate, might have worked back in the 1700s, but is it really fair now to have two Senate seats for every state, regardless of how many people are in those states? I mean, you're talking about things that don't just affect the people in those states. You're talking about things like confirming Supreme Court justices, derailing abortion rules, all kinds of things that affect people in the populous states as well as the unpopulated states. So is it really fair to have such equal representation based on borders, based on land, and not on people? I ran some numbers, and this was fun, actually. And I reached some interesting conclusions. Right now, what is it? We have 51 to 49. Is that what it is? 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats in the Senate. It's really close, but they have a razor-thin margin. Now, if you attach the population of each state to each Senate seat, all right, so what you do is you take the population of a state, and if both senators are Democrats, well, then that entire population counts as Democrat. It sounds unfair. It is unfair, but that's kind of the system that's used now because it's winner take all. Now, if it's two Republicans, okay, all Republicans, the entire population is counted as Republican. If it's one Democrat and one Republican, then they get half and half. All right. So if you do it that way, if you add up the entire population of the country and give credit to the states that are Democrat as completely Democrat and split the ones that are split and give Republicans credit, the Democrats then get a 52 to 48 majority based on population. It's not radically different, but it's different enough to be decisive. Now, you can do something else, too, which is kind of interesting. You take the entire population, and right now the entire population is estimated at about 327 million people. You divide that by 100, because there's 100 Senate seats. That gives an indication of how many people each of those 100 Senate seats would represent if they were divided proportionately. And, of course, that number is 3,272,787. It's basically the population divided by 100. Now, if you use that system, get this, 21 states, nearly half, wouldn't have enough of a population to represent 1/100 of the people. Not enough for one Senate seat, let alone two. Yeah. The overall population of those 21 states, if you add them all together, would qualify for 11 Senate seats. And the other 89 go to the remaining states that do have enough people. Just so you know, the states that don't have enough people to qualify for even one Senate seat based on population. You ready for this? Utah, Iowa, get to Iowa in a second, Nevada, Arkansas, Mississippi, Kansas, New Mexico, Nebraska, West Virginia, Idaho, Hawaii, New Hampshire, Maine, Montana, Rhode Island, Delaware, South Dakota, North Dakota, Alaska, Vermont, and Wyoming. Imagine that. All of that is a slim minority based on population, but a majority based on Senate seats. It's crazy. It is extremely crazy. Now, if you use existing Senate representation for those remaining states, those remaining 21 states, you would get 7 Republican seats, 4 Democrat seats. 4 Democratic seats, that's almost 2-1. And that's how it's reflected now in the actual Senate, 2-1, even though it's not based on population. Now, if you use this system based on population, California would have 12 Senate seats. Think about that, 12 Senate seats as opposed to the 11 seats that those 21 states would qualify for. In other words, California qualifies for more Senate seats than 21 states put together. Yeah. California would have 12 Senate seats, Texas would have 9, Florida would have 7, New York would have 6. And for those 4 populated states, Democrats would have an 18 to 16 advantage. Not huge, but significant. And for the states that qualified for at least one Senate seat, Democrats would have a 49 to 40 advantage. And overall, look at this, they would have a 53 to 47 advantage, very close to the 52 to 48. It seems to be kind of consistent based on population. Now, you might say, this is completely unfair. Why? Why is this unfair, yet having 2 senators for every state, regardless of population, why is that fair? Why is that something we've come to accept? Every system is going to have people that complain about it, that say it doesn't quite represent. But I think when you have people being represented equally, I think that's the fairer system. It sure seems fair. Now, I said I was going to get back to Iowa. Why is Iowa so damn important? You know, they don't even qualify for a Senate seat under this this system. And yet, every single presidential election, they are the ones everyone is paying attention to. You do badly in Iowa, you got to drop out of the race. You know, it's something that I don't get. Why don't they randomize it? Why can't it be a different state every time that starts things off? Iowa's not exactly a diverse place. And yet, if you don't make it in Iowa, you're not going to make it in the rest of the country. So you add all these things up. You add Electoral College, you add the Senate misrepresentation, and you add up the disproportionate significance of Iowa, and throw in the gerrymandering as well. You realize we don't really have that democratic system. You think?
Yeah, that's impressive. My eyes were glazing over with some of those numbers, but it's a really good breakdown of exactly what's going on. But it's a lot to ask the average voter to have to understand that and then fix it. I mean, these are people that just want to get their ballots. Mm-hmm. They want to be represented. They want to have a job. They want to get on with their lives. Well, they should not have to wade through that.
But how do you fix it? You have to change the Constitution, and that's something that apparently we cannot do.
That's our valid curse. It's valid. You know, you have to take an interest.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, we've made it so difficult to change the Constitution that it's almost impossible to move from this archaic system that might have worked a few hundred years ago, but is in serious need of updating now. How do we get out of this?
I don't know. It's a valid point, and it's really perplexing that people stand for it and participate in it, but it is so woefully broken in those regards. But okay,
that was my my homework assignment. I did that over the past a few hours. It took a while to do that.
I'm impressed. That was really succinct.
Yeah. Well, if you have feedback, please write to us. We'd like to hear your opinions on this. But right now, it's time for us to catch up quickly on some of the films that we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks. As you know, or may not know, we have been journeying through the Academy Award-winning feature films since the beginning of the Academy Awards back in the 1920s until present. And we're currently... we got a couple of years to cover. 1952, we left things off at. That was The Greatest Show on Earth. It was produced, directed by Cecil B. DeMille, and starred Charlton Heston, James Stewart, who dressed as a clown the entire film, Dorothy L'Amour. It was a good film. It was all about, you know, a lot of access to the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. You saw the circus train. You saw the actual camp, what they put things together. It was educational. It was a bit melodramatic, but I don't know. Some people say it was the worst film to ever win the Academy Award. I'm not sure. I thought it was entertaining. It did beat out a couple of other films that probably should have won, You know what was interesting about this was that the actors actually had to learn the circus tricks. The actors actually had to learn how to fly in a trapeze.
It's like the equivalent of being a modern-day stunt person, like doing your own stunts.
Yeah, we talk about how culture has changed since Woodstock. Man, culture has changed since this time. Cornell Wilde, I believe, was one of the stars. He had a fear of heights, and yet he starred as a trapeze artist. He actually had to fly through the sky. I mean, how do you do that? How do you tell somebody, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio, you're going to have to be a trapeze artist for the next film. Go ahead, learn how to do that.
And a bunch of the scenes featured no net.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they had a net for the actors.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't want to spoil any of
No, spoil away. Go ahead.
Well, I think that at one point there's a fall, and you can kind of tell that there's a cushion on the floor, but it's supposed to be the dirt floor.
That was sloppy. That was something that actually they shouldn't have shown. But yeah, somebody fell off a trapeze and hit the ground. They're supposed to hit the ground hard, but you could see them hitting a cushion.
Right.
It was
most expressly not a net, because there was nets and as a part of the rigging and the buildup you see from the authentic circus stuff. I like the circuit. They have tractors. Who knew? But there's tractors that are required to pull the parts and pieces of the big top and... have these massive crews of people running the tent from one side to the other and, mm-hmm. and raising it. And it was really kind of historically interesting from just the logistics point of view. But the story was, it was okay.
It was pretty good. And let's see, From Here to Eternity was the film that won the next year.
53?
Yeah, 1950. It was actually the 1954 Academy Awards, but it was for a film from 1953.
Okay.
And that was a kind of a romantic drama based in Hawaii in 1941, which turned out to be a very pivotal year.
Oh, yeah, I remember now.
That starred Burt Lancaster, Montgomery Clift, Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra was really good in that. And apparently he was at the lowest point in his career. He did this film for almost nothing, didn't sing at all, not really, played a really sympathetic character. But mostly it's about these people that are basically in the military before World War II begins in earnest. And basically just trying to survive and
they were stationed there, and it's sort of a couple of different love interests and love triangles and that sort of thing kind of in the run-up right before.
Montgomery Clift was turned out to be a boxer from a different regiment who was transferred, and basically the commanders were trying to get him to join their boxing team, but he didn't want to do that because he had made a guy blind, his friend blind, the last time he had boxed, so he was determined not to do that. So basically it's about how the military tortures people sometimes. Now, the military did not like this film. They tried to get them to change quite a bit. In fact, it's based on a book where it's much more condemning of what goes on in the military.
It was sanitized a little bit.
Yeah, they did manage. They did manage to change quite a few things.
But not fully, right?
Not fully, not fully. And the Department of Defense did not like that very much at all. And then, of course, at the end of the film, you got to see the Pearl Harbor surprise attack and how that affected everybody. And, that definitely changed some lives at the end of that film. Good film, though. It definitely had you on the edge of your seat. Again, black and white, but which I think added to it.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting just the timing they chose, because everything from World War II is still very, very fresh. And a lot of these films have featured bits and pieces of it.
You consider 1953, that's only 12 years after Pearl Harbor in the first place.
Yeah, so it kind of, the ending and that era starting really just didn't need to have any kind of illustration, or it went without saying what was next, but this story happening right before that is sort of interesting. Yeah, I think that then they showed a little bit of file footage and stuff like that of the actual air raids and stuff.
Now, in 1953, for whatever reason, the Academy chose not to award any foreign film with an award, so we skipped over foreign films for that year. But in 1955, they gave an award actually to a 1953 Japanese film translated to Gate of Hell. Tells the story of a samurai who tries to marry a woman he rescues, only to discover that she is married. It basically is the first ever stalker film, because this guy just gets so, enamored and obsessed with this woman that he just won't stop. He says, you know, if you don't come with me, I'll kill your husband, I'll kill your aunt, and I'll kill you. I don't know what the motivation is there, but basically she agrees, says, okay, if that's what you want, that's what I'll do. But she tricks him so that when he thinks he's killing her husband, he's actually killing her. And then he sees the error of his ways, and he begs forgiveness. No, he doesn't beg forgiveness. He begs for the husband to kill him because he's been such a jerk. But the husband says, oh, what good would that do? Wouldn't bring her back. So you know what? Let's just move on to something else, and we'll learn a lesson from this. Oh, by the way, it took place in 1100, so I guess values were a little bit different then.
This film was a little bit boring for me, and there was the return of the laughing character. Do you remember? you had to do it.
Every Japanese film has characters that laugh like that. It's just really annoying. Did people do that then?
You know, I was wondering if it was like an inside thing. They were trying to refer to the previous film that we watched.
The last one we saw was exactly the same thing.
But maybe it was like a cameo or like a reference. But who knows? Who knows?
That's it. Turn the projector off. We're out of time for that, and we raced through three films, and we're going to see another film, and hopefully we'll just do one or two films a week instead of having to race through all of this. But hey, as our outro tonight, you suggested this, Kyle, that actually after Woodstock, National Lampoon put out an amazing parody called Lemmings, where basically it was a massive concert where everybody gathered to kill themselves. And they had music. They had John Belushi giving the stage announcements. And it was all based on Woodstock.
Wasn't it Bill Murray too? Or?
Bill Murray was in it. I don't know if we'll hear it in this clip, but we will hear a musical piece and we'll hear some stage announcements.
It's hilarious.
You can write to us, OTW at 2600.com, and tune in next week when we'll be back.
I think you have this on vinyl.
So. We do. We do. Yeah. Good night.
Can I have your attention, please? There's still some people coming in. So for the benefit of you people who just paid to get in, from now on, the Woodchuck Festival of Peace, Love, and Death is a free concert! All right, a free concert. This doesn't mean you can do anything you want to do. It means you gotta do what you're told. Okay, now we all know why we came here. A million of us. We came here to off ourselves. We want you people who are into macrobiotics to off yourself over in the South 40 to be used for organic fertilizer. Now, if your buddy's too stoned to off himself, roll him up in a sleeping bag and drag him over to where the tractors can ride over. Stuck in this old city now, where living ain't no fun, where stealing glass and concrete cancel out the wind and sun. And I'm thinking of last winter now, when we walked hand in hand in the trails of the Colorado Rockies. Wind sang us a lullaby, the snow was thick as cream, and icicles were chandeliers like crystals in a dream. And the streams were strips of diamonds, and the hills were white as snow, and a bear ate all our soybeans in the night. Oh, Colorado's calling me from her hillsides and her rivers and her mesas and her trees. When blizzards snap the power lines and all the toilets freeze in December in the Colorado Rockies. Time and space and freedom, we had love and peace to spare. Though we ran out of things to smoke, say and eat and wear. In the morning of the avalanche, the Yeti kidnapped Blanche and took her to his cave up in the Rockies. Oh, Colorado's calling me from her glaciers and her canyons and her badlands and ravines. And infectious hepatitis was all that came to stay in January in the Colorado Rockies. Baby didn't die until we burned up all our wood. Considering we ate her raw, she tasted pretty good. And the fascist health inspectors dug us out, mailed us home. Except for Blanche, wouldn't leave her maid. Oh, Colorado's calling me. From her mountains and her rivers and her meadows and her trees, they tell me I'll be cured soon, thawed and ready to return when it's